Test. Off we go, Pauline.
Where do you want me to begin?
Okay. So when just before the tape where you left off for the second tape, you were talking about how the boys found a dead body. So we might as well get that at the beginning and then go back to the other stuff because I've got half of it.
Oh, right. Well, one afternoon after school, they'd been down swimming, and they came back, and they were arguing between the two of them, and then I said, "What is the matter?" And my eldest son said, "We found a body, we think it's dead." I said, "Where?" They said, "Down at Point Ormond." So I said, "Oh, well, are you sure?" And they sort of didn't want to give me any further information of what had transpired, but I did find out later that they had got the body, turned it over and seen the face and turned it back again. So that's what made them think they'd better come and tell me. So I immediately rang the police and I said, "Well, we better go down and just..." They said, "Well, are you sure?" I said, "No, I'm not. Well, I'll go and make sure." But by the time I'd got to the Point, the police were already there and had the whole area cordoned off. And it wasn't until some time later that it was supposed to be, they thought it was someone off a ship that had fallen overboard.
Mm. Do you want to say something?
Yes, I'm using
the phone. Well, be quick.
We'll turn it off?
Yes, it might be a good idea to do that.
It will be all right.
Yes, okay then.
Okay, so...
Because he's very quiet out there.
Yes.
Mm.
Can you tell me about the Grass Islands?
The Grass Islands are now, of course, under the reclaimed land between the canal and what used to be the Port Orbit Pier, down right close to the point. There were approximately 8 islands, about 8 feet across to about 10 foot across. They were round. They stood about 15 to 18 inches above the sand bottom, and they had a foot around them that you could lift up the edge, and the cockles used to hang underneath. You could gather your cockles and have boiled cockles curried. It used to be lovely. But in the summertime, they were always underwater in the winter. In the summertime, they would be open and you could go down there and lay on them. And it was beautiful to do all our sunbathing down on the seagrass islands. We called them seagrass islands. What they actually were, we don't know. But you never saw them anywhere else.
And did your grandfather used to take you down there before breakfast?
My grandfather used to take me to the canal and lower me in to get his worms so he could go fishing at 6 o'clock in the morning. He used to wake me up and he'd say, "Come on, girl, it's time, I need my worms." He'd lower me down and then I'd have to clamber up partway on the rings that are along the side of the canal where the boats used to tie up. And it was called the Venice of Elwood at one stage. And sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, you could go for a ride up the canal for sixpence.
And who used to run
the fishermen, boat? Just the fishermen that used to go out into the sea along of an evening, every evening towards dusk, when the tide was turning one way or another. They'd be not very far off the wall. They'd be almost, you could get out and walk, and they'd be catching their fish every night.
So the clams, the cockles that sat under the edge of the
seagrass island,
did a lot of people collect them?
I don't know. I've no idea if they knew they were there or if they weren't.
So it was you and your family?
Oh, my grandfather knew, and I presume the other fishermen, he used to go, he was a retired man, and he used to meet his mates down there on the Point Ormond Pier, and they would probably all know about it. I know Mr. Williams would have known, and Mr. Williams was a very wealthy gentleman that lived on the corner of Dickens Street and Barclay Street in a two-storey home.
And how did you cook them?
I'd boil them. You'd boil them, and they'd open out of their shells, and then you'd add the curry and whatever you wanted.
And were they very big?
Like that, like
about 4 centimetres.
Yeah, something
couple
like
of inches.
Yeah, about that. They were round like that, and then you'd have your. It's like very like a the size of a scallop. That would be the best size I could say what they were.
And you told me another story about how the fish and chip family, the fish shop.
Oh, there used to be a fish shop in Ackland Street on the north side. And it was run by Italians. And the young men there used to bring their grandmother down. And she had a great big black flowing dress from her neck to her feet. And she used to wear a huge hat, and they used to, she couldn't walk, and they would carry her in the out of the car and down the ramp and put her on the sand between the seagrass islands and the pier. That's where they used to put her, and she used to catch the fish in her hands, and it was particularly mullets, and she was fast. She was very fast, and they would leave her there, then they'd come back and get her at lunchtime, and then they'd bring her down again in the afternoon. This went on for several months. So it was always very fresh fish that they got. That's the sweetness of the gutters. You wouldn't believe it, would you? You just wouldn't. He never comes. You wouldn't believe it.
Oh, they'll start with the sniffing neck. They've got a mob on it at the moment. Oh, yeah, that's rubbish. And what did she collect? How did she contain the fish?
She had a gummy bag, and she used to slide them in the gummy bag, and she was very, very fast. She'd shove them down, had the gummy bag under the water, and she'd shove it in, and it'd swim once it got free from her hand. Swim straight into the bag, you see.
What's a gummy bag?
A sugar bag. Like a sugar bag.
And so they stayed alive?
Yes, so they were all still alive. And she could be there all day and the fish would be alive because they'd be swimming around in the bag.
And what sort of fish?
Mullet, mainly. We used to get lovely sized mullets. Here, young mullets, they were very nice and very, very tasty. I could try and catch them with a net, but you'd have to be very fast. I could never, she just said, boom! She just grabbed them. Oh, I've never seen anything like what she was like.
And then you told me about how you used to go floundering?
Oh, just after dusk, just before it got fully dark, and we used to have we cut about a 5-foot piece of timber off a tree, and we'd do it with a penknife. We'd scrape it all so that it was all clean and fresh, and then we'd make a point on the end, and then on another one of those, we'd tie a torch. Now, they were rubber torches we used to get in those days. We never ever thought about them being waterproof or anything. We just used to use the torches, and we'd have the torch alight, and we'd put it under the water, and you'd see the flounder just shivering the sand. But you had to be careful it wasn't a stingray you were going to spear, because they'd be in the same area as the flounders. So, but you'd see the flounder, and we used to wear rubber shoes, and we used to just touch the sand, push it with our feet, so that it would tremble and just move, and so the flounder would flutter, and then you'd see him bang, down you go with the spear. And again, we put it in the gummy bag, sugar bag.
So
fence to bring it home.
Last time you described to me how you moved your feet.
That's right, we moved the sand so that the flounder would move, you see. Once they were disturbed, they'd move. So would the...
And you described it something like a shh.
Yes, we're shushing. Yeah, we used to shush through with our feet. We'd glide through on the sand. We never lifted our feet because if you lift the feet, you cause a disturbance in the water. So you just shuffled your feet along so that the only thing that you'd be moving would be the sand. And if they felt the sand move, they'd flutter. And then you'd see them and catch them.
And who did you do that with?
Oh, there'd be about half a dozen of us, all everyone in the neighbourhood. We'd all get together.
And
boys across the road, some up the street, the girls would come, and some of them had girlfriends, and the girls would come and get into their shorts and shoes, and away we'd go.
What age were you?
We were from 14 up to 17 during all this.
And how long, you know, would you stay out really late, or would it
be... Oh, no, we'd be in again by, well, there wasn't any daylight saving then. So we'd be in by 8:30, well in, because it'd be dusk and the fishermen would be out, because they'd go out just about 5:30, and when it was getting dusk, and then they'd come in at 8:00, so once we saw the fishermen gone, we'd come in.
And would you have that for dinner?
No, normally you'd have it because it'd have to be scale gutted. And we'd have it, it would be well past dinner time. It'd be for the next night, you see, always for the next night. We'd go into the ice chest. We didn't have freezers then.
And the stingrays, did anybody ever get stung by the stingrays?
Oh yes, that was a common occurrence. And also the stingrays used to be on the Elwood Beach during the daytime. Certain times of the year, they'd come in and you'd run down to get into the water and you'd stand on one and he'd whip up his tail and bingo, you'd get it in the thigh. Many times that happened.
So the barb or the whack?
The barb. The barb itself would sting you. The tip of the barb would sting you.
Do you know anybody who was?
Yes, I was.
Yes? And what would happen?
Oh, it was like a blue bottle, if anybody's ever had a blue bottle sting. A bee sting, similar to a bee sting, the pain was excruciating. And you'd come home, madly tear home and get the Ricketts Blue and dab it on. That was the best thing that you could do for that, to ease the pain.
And how big were they?
The stingray would be 2 foot 6. Around, very big, and their sting would come up 2 foot. It was level under the ground. If you were lucky enough to stand on it and stand on them, they hated it. They'd flutter and make an awful test of themselves. So you used to hope that you stood on their tail when you stood. If you don't stand on them, stand on the tail so it couldn't come and hit you. But that's what it was like. And they were along the main beach from Point Ormond down to the boat sheds further down towards the main Elwood Beach, because this was only just the end here. The lifesavers and everything were down there because, well, their beach was 100 yards wide. You know, it was a very wide beach down there. And when you stepped off the brick wall, it was only just less than a foot to step down onto the beach there, right down in Elwood itself.
Can I just check this toilet?
Hmm.
Beautiful. It's all there. Easy last word. And you talked about some... dolphins, your husband?
Oh, the dolphins. Yes, well, my husband was a swimmer in his early days, and he loved swimming, and he was a country champion swimmer, and he'd never swam much because he came from Geelong, and he swam for first Rippleside and then for Geelong West Swimming Club down there, and they used to go away to Daylesford and Creswick and places all up country to do all their swimming from down there. There wasn't a competition with the city. The city groups all met at the Richmond Baths, and they all sort of kept to the city. But the country ones, there was the east side of Victoria, and there was the west side, and there was the north side. There were always competitions in three areas of the country, and he was in the west side. And he'd go to Portland and down right into the country, all right round just where they were swimming. But when after the war, during the war when we were living here, when he came back from overseas, and later when we had the children and that, we got married during the war when he came back, and we used to go down. I was never one for open water because of experience I'd had when we lived in Sydney on the surf beaches with sharks. So I was always very timid about going in anything over my waist. Even that scared me. But he never thought a thing about it. He'd go way out and I used to be frightened the whole time he was there. The dolphins are in the bay constantly, but not in the same place all the time. They visit the areas round the bay at different times of the year. It's all to do with the tides that moves them in the majority of cases. A lot of people might dispute that, but the old fishermen were the ones to talk to tell you all the stories about those things. And they were the stories they told us, and they were the stories I learnt. And when the dolphins used to visit the Elwood Beach around, they'd be here, they'd stay for two and a half, maybe 3 months. They'd stay around the area from Port Melbourne down to Black Rock. That was their area for traversing. And if you were lucky enough, they'd come. Now, somehow they always used to know when my husband was out on his mad swim from Point Ormond right down to Brighton. And he was out, and that used to frighten me, was so far out that whenever I saw the dolphins, I never got afraid because I knew they'd protect him. And I knew he was safe. The only trouble was, when he swam back, he didn't have them coming back with him. They always went with him, but never came back because it wasn't their mode of doing things. They'd go round across the bay and then come round again. They always go in the one direction. Surprisingly.
And did you tell me a story about being taught to fish?
Yes. I always used to, my grandfather getting me up to get his worms of the morning, and I'd say to him, can I go today? I've got the day off. I'm not going to school today. I've got a day off from work. Can I go with you today? No, no, no. You can never go fishing. In the end, one day I tormented the very devil out of him, and he agreed to take me. And he said, you must do everything you are told. And he tried to, he used to make his own fishing rods, but most of the fishermen did. And they were beautiful rods too. And anyhow, he said, all right, we'll go. And I went. So he then introduced, I knew Mr. Williams and I knew some of the other gentlemen by name, that I'd met them at different times. And anyhow, they just sort of moved their fishing gear to give me room along the railing of the pier. There was only one railing one side. The other side, there was no railing at all.
And how many people would be fishing?
I would say there would be 20 retired old gentlemen with their rods along the line, and they all had their rods out. And so he said, now remember what I told you, throw it straight out as far as you can go. So I got the rod and I baited it as I had been shown how to do, and I swung the thing. First of all, I hooked it in the shelf as well as equally did him, and he was getting very cross with me. And then I just threw it as hard as I could go, but instead of throwing it straight out, I threw it straight across all the other fishermen's lines. Well, there was to do in the half, and I was dismissed from the pier in no uncertain terms with the notice, do not try to come back. And I never did.
And how old were you?
I was 16.
And do you think that they would have shown a bit more tolerance if you had been a boy having a go the first time?
Oh, undoubtedly, undoubtedly. It is a similar thing that had happened to me in Sydney when we went crab gathering, and I tormented my father. He was alive then, and I tormented my father and his two friends. I want to get a crab too. My father had no success at getting any crab because you had to lay on the rocks and lean over, and the waves had come in and bang and hit you in the face. You had to be careful you weren't washed off the rocks and that. And in the end, I decided to go. I wasn't going to ask anymore, so I went along. I was nine at the time, and I went along and I clambered down, got a crab and came back and said, "Never mind, Daddy." Oh, and he had no success, and he wouldn't talk to me for the rest of the day. So I, at 50, I'm not a very good person, I know. Right?
Well, you didn't really get an opportunity, did you?
No,
you
not
have,
really.
If you hadn't had that one mishap at the first try, you might have ended up.
I might have. I doubt it. I haven't got the patience to sit in a boat. I want to get up and keep walking around. You can't walk around on the water. I'm not very good at walking on the water, I can tell you. So.
You talk quite a lot about, the old landscape of Elwood. We just came back from a little trip. And I suppose I'd like you to talk just a little, give me a brief overview of maybe not so much the physical, the precise physical features, but maybe sort of like the feeling of it, because you were doing a beautiful job of describing how wild and woolly it was.
Well, there's so much land being reclaimed down there. We've lost so much as the oceans. And it was just lovely on an evening just to walk from here one street and you are right on the water. And the wall was 2 foot high so that you could sit on the wall, cross the road and across the sand that had all been washed over the top at various stages, with all sand right along on that side of the road. And then you had the 2 foot wall and you looked down good 10 foot to the bottom, right round from Point Ormond, right round to that Blessington Street beach there where the little groin went out. And It was just so lovely of an evening to walk down there. Even in the winter, as the wind storms were going, you'd rug up and go down there and watch the sea and watch the violence that it would crash against the rocks and watch it up to 12 foot high coming over in water right across the road. No way could any car ever pass down there. And we weren't the only ones. People would come out. Dozens of them would come down and look and watch it. It was something fascinating. It was nature showing you what it could do with its violence, particularly in storms. We'd always go down when there was a storm because it was just so marvellous to watch. Another thing that we used to see down there, which I haven't seen for a long time, I believe they still can be seen on occasions, was the water spouts. Now, you'd see four or five or six water spouts at a time. One had come up another one would come up, another one would come up, and then they might drop low, and then others would come up, and then they might all drop. But all of a sudden, one great big one, and then it would come rushing across the water towards you, and you think, oh, we're going to get it this time. But no.
What is that?
A spout of water. It would generate itself underneath, and to such speed, it would come up in a spout to anything up to 300 foot. And it would stand there spouting water like that, like a geyser. And it would be about 300 feet, and then all of a sudden, it would drop. And it would be gone. What caused it? Why they came? I don't know. But they were regular. And they came, we had a storm. And the geysers came up, and they mowed up the canal. Right up the canal to Tennyson Street. It took the roof off the flat houses. Every house that had a flat roof lost their roof.
With the water starts.
With the water starts.
Wow.
Mm.
And you said that you'd wonder whether or not the next one wouldn't pop up and get you.
Yes, because they used to come straight for the canal. They'd come across the water from Port Melbourne or Williamstown. They'd be as far away as that. The Williamstown ones wouldn't be that high to us here. But the Port Melbourne ones were. And they'd come across the bay. They would come round, sort of. They'd come straight across. And being an entrance off with water, particularly if the tide was incoming, they could be drawn in with the incoming tide. If it was an outgoing tide, they'd get to a couple of hundred feet off the end of the canal, and then they'd die because the tide was going out and it could stop them. Now, fortunately, with the canal, you've either got a tide coming in or you've got a tide going out. It's never stationary. So that is one blessing with the canal, this end to Glen Huntly Road. You've got its tidal. You've got tide in, tide out. So that's always a great help. And it's between that area that you don't get flooded. It's beyond Glen Huntly Road, it's the streets beyond that, foam, waves, spray, and Tennyson Street, or St Kilda Street, they are the ones that always got flooded.
Is that why they were called foam, wave, and spray?
I am. No doubt it was.
you mentioned about cars not being able to drive.
Oh, damn Marine Parade. What was the Marine Parade then? No, because the sea coming over that rock, the sea would be anything up to from mainly 5-6 feet high up to 10-12 feet, and it would come across. It was just a two-lane road. You know, one lane going one way, one lane going the other. Now, the lane going towards Point Auburn could mainly get through, but the lane going towards St Kilda from Point Auburn could not get through because they'd be absolutely drowned in a huge wave of water. And it was too dangerous to drive because that wave would be violent and it could blow the car anywhere, in any given direction, crash it, turn it, do anything. It was too dangerous. And those waves were strong. That was seeing the sea with its might.
And I remember when we met on the phone, you know, several years ago, I think you only were talking about, you know, kids running, making a dash.
Oh, they used to say, wait, the next one, and then they'd run through, trying to run through under it. Oh, yes, the boys did. The girls didn't. They had more sense. The boys would get tumbled, and it was dangerous because they'd get blown onto the road, washed onto the road, actually, because these waves, when they were very high, they never did it when it was very high.
Can you explain
what they did? Well, they used to get one end. See, there used to be certain parts where the waves came over. It didn't come over right along. There was only just one part. It was from Meredith Street to Dickens Street. It was in that area. Now, not right along, not all at the one time. Sometimes there'd only be one part. sometimes they only just come over the wall and just land in the 12-foot strip between the wall and the road, which was just sand and mud and slush in the winter time, and potholy and everything like that. What they'd come, they'd be part of the wave had come up, because you didn't have a long wave. You had a wave following a wave, or a wave on top of a wave. Very hard to describe if you haven't seen one. But you had a wave on, now the first wave had come over, but the second wave would crash over the top of that. And that was the dangerous wave. That was the one you had to be careful of.
And would the houses suffer?
The houses never, ever, during the winter time, you could never see out of any of the front windows onto Marine Parade at all. And it was not much good doing anything about them, because they were constantly covered with sea mist. All the time covered with sea mist. Even in the springtime particularly, when the spring tides were around, of course there was always water crashing over down there. They used to leave the sea mist on the thing. You could go in there and all you'd see was a blur. You'd see things through a blur, you know. And that was like, and you could never paint your house. You had to paint all the inside walls and everything of your house with oil paint to protect it because of the salt. And we used to get the mist on the windows here when the wall was up close, within Marine Parade, up close.
And you talked about the sand, the sands of signing
out. Every year we always lost our beach, this end of Elwood, between where the life-saving club is and the point. You'd go down, and we used to swim right up till the end of May, and we'd start swimming, usually get one in August. And you'd go down there, or perhaps for a walk in May, and lovely, you'd walk along the sand and take the children, and they'd play in the sand and all that sort of thing. The next Sunday you might decide to do the same thing. There wasn't any sand to walk along. It was gone. And then it would be gone, all the winter months it would be gone, and the sea would come up and come almost right up to the wall, right along, not completely, but almost up, and there'd be seaweed left, and there'd be all sorts of debris from ships left on the sand there, and go down, people would go down and collect all sorts of things, and it was great to collect the firewood, made wonderful chips for burning. So you always got that in the winter time. We used to fill up our chip boxes along the beach. We'd all take a couple of bags each and pick up all the chips and bring them home. And they burned well. They really did burn very well to start the fires up. And then you'd go down in August and think, oh, I wonder how much longer we've got to wait. And you'd go down the following Sunday and you've got 100 yards of sand. Come from nowhere at all. And it was all back. And you knew you were then right for the whole summer. Even with the spring tides in October, they might wash a bit away and shift it around. It might not be to their liking. You always think that Mother Sea, she'd say, well, it's not just quite where I want it all to be. So she'd take a little bit away from what she'd given you and take it a bit further around to somewhere else and still in their beaches. But gradually they'd all come right down through to St Kilda. Middle Park never had a beach. Their beach always disappeared. I've never known them to have a beach at all.
As it did last year.
That's right.
And do you remember the storm that took out the Elwood Pier?
Yes, that was one of the most horrendous storms we had had. It was very destructive. But it wasn't only just destructive here. It was destructive everywhere. My husband and I were down at Phillip Island for the Easter. And they took the pier. It took the giant Norfolk pines that had been there for nearly 100 years down on Phillip Island. The sea came over. We were staying at the Isle of Wight Hotel, and they called us to come down. And they said that the fishermen said that don't go any closer than this, that we were well back up the road. And everybody went from the hotel and from houses around everywhere. It was sort of a call, you know, come, we must be all here to stay together. And it was like a hand that came up, just took these 200-foot Norfolk pines, picked them up, and just took them out into the sea. Just like that. And the pier, where the boats used to come from Melbourne, and, you know, if you wanted to go for a boat trip down to Phillip Island, you could from Melbourne, like from Williamstown you could go. And the posts, the pylons, great big pylons like this that had been put there in the 1800s, and they just picked those up and just gulped them into chipwood. I have never seen anything like it in my life. When we came back on the Easter Monday, Mum said, we've lost the Point Ormond Pier. So that storm that they had was right around the south coast of Victoria, that Easter weekend. That would be approximately 1944. I think it would be the Easter of
1944. And was there
discussion about rebuilding the pier? No. It was decided, they bought Point Ormond. No, it was decided it wasn't worth it. It didn't. The pier we had was only a one-sided, it only had railings on one side. It was just 5 foot wide. It wasn't a very wide pier, and it didn't really do anything because you could only bring a rowing boat in there because of all the rocks, because the rocks were out so far all round out there. The pier went out about 500 feet. It wasn't even a long pier. But that was the sort of the pier that they had when they made the landing down there at Glen Huntly. It was one of those early ones that had been put in there so boats could come to this side from Williamstown across. And, well, there was no necessity for that. We had a bridge.
Did the fishermen get upset about it?
No, it never worried them at all. They never worried because they went down to Kerford Road. I mean, down to Kerford Road or down to the pier down at Blessington Street. See, that was just as close. They just wandered down there. It was a much better, stronger pier down there, and I liked that just as well. And it was.
Is there a pier at Blessington Street?
Just beyond Blessington Street. It was called the Blessington. In those days, it was called the Blessington
Street.
Is it still there? Is that one by the drain, or is it? Yes, gone? By the one by the drain down there, yes, yes.
Don't fish anymore around here?
Because it costs you to fish. You've got to pay a license to fish. If you want to take, if you want to go and take a fishing rod and go down fishing, you first have got to get a license to do so. And then you're only allowed to take fish at a certain size. Well, the boats take all the fish now, and so it's very difficult to get a fish at the 10-inch or 12-inch size from nose to tail, like you used to be able to get. And garfish, one of the big things that they used to catch down here at Point Ormond were garfish, and they were thick like that. Now, garfish you get now, you're lucky if you get a little bit of meat off the bone, but in those days, well, the bone was very tiny to the size of the fish. It was, they were that long, and when you cut the head in half, you still had a fish at the size you're allowed to catch now.
So that would be about
12 inches.
Mm-hmm.
see. Well, you used to have, that was only, that was after the head and the tail cut off.
Mm.
Now you get the lot of the size of that. And they're only small. And, you know, you've got to pick between the bones. So they're not a very popular fish. The big fat ones are gone, and they were fat. I mean, so you really got a meal.
When we were having our walk, you talked about how the when the migration started, mass migration to Australia, you were talking about...
Oh, after the war, after the Second World War. Yes, there were a lot of people came from Italy. We had a lot of Italians and Greeks. And lots of Italians came out too with the Snowy River scheme was started in New South Wales. Well, after being out in at Adaminaby and where the scheme all was, and Cabramatta, Matha, the highest town in Australia, I don't know if you know that or not, but it is, and that was started and organised at the top of the mountains when the Snowy River scheme was on. And they didn't want to stay out in the wilderness any longer. They decided they wanted to come and start a family, and they made money, and they wanted to set up businesses. The Snowy River scheme was over, and so they migrated to Sydney and Brisbane and Adelaide and Melbourne. And so a lot of them came from there.
And you were telling me...
And their son started growing up, the same as my son started growing up. And they used to come on the bus. The bus used to finish at Point Ormond. It didn't go through to Ralston Neck then. It finished at Point Ormond because we didn't have the Glen Huntly Road right round and through and back right then. And... they used to come down and they would get undressed down there, and then after they'd done their swimming and they probably had a little bit of vino, the boys would get undressed. The girls would all be starting to come down, local girls would be coming down, and they'd get it, take their togs off and get out on the rocks and stand naked and say, "Look at me! I'm here! I'm in! And we used to, oh, my son, "Oh, look at that, Mummy." And I'd say, "That's enough of that." Oh, dear, oh, dear. And their father'd say, "Oh, for goodness sake, not them again." Oh, dear, oh, dear, yes.
So the beach must have changed quite a bit when the European families...
Well, they didn't have any other beach. They found it with their families and their furnaces and their food hampers. They always brought great huge food hampers with them, and the vino for the papa. And they used to find it was difficult to get off at St Kilda, because I had quite a long distance to go to walk down to the actual St Kilda beach. So it was much better to come to Point Ormond, where the buses terminated, and they turned round, of course, in Barclay Street, you know, that there was no Glen Huntly Road there, and so the buses terminated there, and so you might have three or four buses terminated down there, and they would get off packed to the hilt. They were absolutely packed. And the hampers and the towels and the surf, the surfboards then were not like the surfboards now. They were quite different, more squarer and stumpier. And they'd have those, and they were made of rubber blow-up ones, and some of them had already been blown. They'd blown them up in the bus coming down to have them ready to go in the water. Some of them, they'd change the children on the bus out of their dresses and things into their togs as they were coming. Oh, you have no idea. And if you wanted to get on the bus anywhere from the bell to here, say goodnight, you walked. You didn't try. You couldn't. There was nowhere to get on unless you hung on the step.
So before that, was the beach really crowded on a hot day? Was it, or was it more of a local beach?
Elders always a very popular beach. Always a popular beach. And, of course, there weren't the cars in those days as what there is now. Very few families had cars. Mainly you went everywhere on transport. We used to have a bus that went along, well, the bus still goes along Broadway, and that goes to, it used to go to Brighton, and then up to St Kilda. Well, a lot of youth people used to come on that bus, and they used to get off round in Ormond Road and go down to different areas along Ormond Road down to St Kilda Street, to different points down at Elwood Beach. So that they had, this was a that was a local bus because it locally finished here in St Kilda, whereas the bus along here, which didn't, I might add, start until 'cause we had a tram. You see, there was the tram that went from Ackland Street down to Brighton Beach. See, we used to have that tram down there, and I can't think when that stopped. And that used to go to the railway station. See, we had trains then, and that was that used to meet the trains and ferried people all round through there. So people came from other suburbs, Newport and Footscray and all of those areas over there, because there was no Altona Beach at that stage. And so they would come from over there to the down to St Kilda, and they would then catch the tram down Fitzroy Street at the St Kilda Street. They didn't realise that you could get on the tram that would come round to Elwood that could take you round to Brighton, because that tram that went round Broadway terminated at Brighton Beach, South Road, Brighton Beach.
And another one of the stories you were telling me before was about how the Jewish community used to do the blessing of the sea.
The Jewish community. At the end of Meredith Street, on the beach side, there was a little kiosk, I suppose you'd call it. It's hard to know what it was. It was a rounded, I don't know who built it or how it came there, but it was very old. When we came in here in 1938, it was there then, and it was very old. So I'd say it had been built very much in the 1800s, because it was typical 1800 roof, which was of slate. It was a slate roof. It was pointed at the top, and it had a decoration in iron around the edging of it. Was wrought iron. It was on iron, four iron posts that held it up. I would say it would be all culled across.
Like a little rotunda.
No seats, nothing like that. It would be about 5 foot across the top concrete layer, and then you had a slight step down, and then there was about 8 inches of another ring around, and then you step down just about 2 inches down onto the ground again. It was there right on the edge. The wall came to, the top piece of wall came to each side of that and stopped. It was just right there. And they used to come down by the canal or come down Meredith Street. The Jewish people would walk from wherever, but that's where they would cut in, either the canal or Meredith Street, to go down to this little bit. And there were 2 or 3 days in the year the rabbis would go there, and they would read from their Torah, and then the men would surround him and read from theirs and answer them, and the women stood off and got together and talked families. And the blessing of the sea always took part there, and anyone was welcome to go. And it was something very lovely to see. Mind you,
how many people were there?
Over a day, I would say there'd be 3,000 come and go. They'd start at dawn and go through till dusk.
And were they local people, do you think?
They would walk. They would never be in a car. They would always walk from where they had to come, and they would always walk back. It's in about 5 miles they would walk.
Mm.
And they would come from all of St Kilda and all of Caulfield. Walk down and walk back, and the children would walk too. They'd all walk.
I'm going to get Monday to pay for now because I think I've
run out.
Remembered all that I'm going to remember. I know that there's some. There's the rolling down the hill.
The hill was much sharper. They've taken. It was very, very steep. It was very difficult.
The Point Ormond
itself was very steep, but they've built it up, the lead up to it, they've built it up higher than what it was. It was very, very steep. And my children used to love to roll themselves in newspaper. The Herald was good because it was a big newspaper and they could cover them all themselves. So we always used to have to take a Herald with us. They'd roll themselves in their Herald and Joe always took a little bit of sticky to stick it on them, and then he'd stick them, and down they'd go down the hill, and they used to scream, you know, and laugh and scream and laugh and scream till they rolled down to the bottom.
And would other kids do that as well? Was that
other children used to do it, so that's how they used to do it, and that's, yes, other children used to do it. Oh, yes, it used to be a great thing, and I know if you ever tried, young and all as you were, and healthy and full of, you know, vim and everything, you get halfway up the hill and you would have to stop. I don't care who you were, you could not run up that hill. It just was impossible. Even the kids would get halfway and have to stop. It was very, very steep going up to that. Now it's not. It's not steep at all. And
then you told me another story about walking with the children when they were filling in the land, the tip. So that story.
Oh, down by the canal. They still had a path along. When they started to reclaim the land, they reclaimed it out and built a great, like a lake. It looked as though it was going to be a lake. They surrounded all of the area to the extent of where they were going to go. They said, this is where we're going to go. So they put a whole heap of rocks and things there, and then dirt on the inside and rocks on the outside, and then that was left to be filled. First they did the south side, then they did the north side of the canal. And as they filled with the rubbish and everything, instead of going to the tip, it came to the down here to Elwood. And the garbage trucks had just dropped anything and everything like you'd pick up out of the garbage tip. And it gradually, of course, drew rat after rat. And one evening after this two-thirds filled in, it still was quite a... You'd go down there, and it was like a sea with a gentle flow. It was just a soft movement that you could see across this whole wasteland. And I said, do you think the tide's coming in underneath and moving that like that? And my husband said, no. He didn't say what he thought it was. And I said, oh, I can't understand that. And the boys said, Mummy, can we throw stones into that? Oh, I said, I suppose you can, love. You know, I said, like a children, that's this water and it's going up and down. They want to throw stones.
Can I bring this for a minute, Pauline? Because last time I recall you saying the boys were throwing rocks on the other side as well.
That's right. Well, they had been throwing it into the canal, and I said, you mustn't throw the rocks into the canal. We've got to keep the bottom of it empty so that the tide can come in and go out. So they said, oh, well, can we throw it into that side, mate? And I said, oh, well, I can't see any reason why you can't. And that's when they threw the rocks, and that's when these thousands of rats about an inch long came tearing. I just jumped on my husband's shoulders. He said, get down. I said, I won't. And I would not. No, I was terrified. So were they. They were up on his shoulder, hanging on each side with their legs around his waist. And poor Joe, he just had to stand there, and they were up and down his trouser legs, and it went on for, I suppose, about 10 minutes, but it seemed like about an hour, you know, and I don't suppose it would be any more than 10 minutes, and then all was silent. And he said, you can get down now, and I said, no, I'm not going to get up. It took a lot of me to get down from there, I tell you. And I was sick. I've never seen so many rats in all my life. And they just went everywhere, all over us.
How big were they,
okay?
How big were they?
About anything from about 8 inches to a foot. Oh, yes, and then their tails were on the end of that. But they were like big water rats, you know, great big water rats. And I knew about water rats because I used to go down by the Yarra when I worked close to the Yarra there, and we'd have lunch there. But we used to throw crumbs to the water rats, but there were only a couple of water rats down there, and they always looked so pretty near the water's edge, at the bottom, you know, and near the Princess Bridge. And so, you know, they didn't worry me, but these things coming at us and running up us, oh, yuck! You know, one after the other and all over your head and your face and arms and everything. Oh, you! No. It was dreadful. It was terrible. And that's exactly what they did to you. Mm. That's what I mean, exactly.
Yeah. Now, you moved here what year?
April. My mother and I moved into this house in April 1938. My grandmother lived in Meredith Street, and we came from Sydney. We landed in Melbourne at Port Melbourne because we had all our luggage, all our furniture on board on the 1st of February 1938, and there were only two car cabs there. The rest were all hansom cabs. So if you wanted a cab, you took a hansom from Port Melbourne to wherever you wanted to go. That was the only way you could tour in those days, in 1938. And so my grandfather hired a hansom cab, and we had our cabin luggage and some other luggage we got from the boot, but the rest of it was sent. We made arrangements. We couldn't make arrangements in Sydney. We made arrangements when we got to Melbourne to go to Mackenzie's in Inkerman Street, which was a storage place where our furniture could go. So it went into storage there till we found somewhere to live, and we came home with my grandmother and grandfather to Meredith Street. Well, my mother decided that my grandmother wasn't terribly well in health at that stage and getting on, and she said, well, I need somebody to go and pick up the rents, because she had a few houses and things. So she said, you'll have to be my agent, she said to Mum. So Mum went straight to work, was going to pick up all the rents for her mother, and in the meantime we looked at several houses. A lot of vacant lots around here then, a tremendous amount of vacant land all around. The two blocks next door to here were vacant, and this house had been built in 1920. It was passed by the council in 1923 to be built, and the man that built this house was a plumber. He built both houses, actually, and he was a plumber by trade, and later his son became an electrician. They lived in Dickon Street, or Mitford Street, near Dickon Street, and his son became our electrician for many, many years. So
it wasn't Roger Beckway.
No, James for the name. The surname's for James.